This is the KOTO Community Radio News for Thursday, March 7th. I'm Gavin McGough.
And I'm Julia Caulfield.
In today's headlines, commissioners decline a mining moratorium.
Taxpayers support mental health services.
Mountain Village makes moves on new trails.
And a mountain weather forecast.
The whispers of a mining revival in the West End have long been circulating. The price of uranium has been on the up and up for 3 or 4 years now, as have prices for fine minerals essential in electrification, car batteries, solar panels, and other green energy technologies. A vast swath of the West End of San Miguel, Montrose, and Mesa counties sits on the Yerevan Mineral Belt, which has a long history of extraction and mining activities. But, says Jennifer Thurston, director of the Information Network for Responsible Mining, that was decades ago.
And, you know, it's been quite sleepy out there in terms of actual mining activity for a while. The Sunday complex, you know, operated briefly. There hasn't been a lot of activity in the West End of San Miguel since then.
Mining fell out of the county's area of concern, says Thurston.
Which, you know, I think allowed the land use code to kind of languish and even get a little more out of date.
Thurston spoke before the Board of County Commissioners this week. The land use code, of course, sets guidelines for all sorts of development projects in the county. Thurston came before the BOCC to request the county put a temporary moratorium, or pause, on all new mining applications until those codes have been updated. She was joined by Mason Osgood of the Sheep Mountain Alliance, the Telluride-based conservation group. Osgood says as mining exploration is restarting in the West End,
I think this is a perfect time to take a step back and just update the land use codes a bit so we can continue to find that balance of mining and conservation interests in this county.
County Planning Director Kay Simonson appeared before the BOCC, and she confirms there's been an uptick in mining exploration applications over the past several years.
There's also a mine in the West End that they're hoping to restart. There was prior litigation, it was finally resolved. But if we put a moratorium in, that's going to put one more barrier in front of them coming into compliance with us. You know, while I understand the importance, and we are seeing, you know, in the last couple of years, we've been seeing an uptick in exploration. At this point, I would not recommend a moratorium.
The county currently has a moratorium on solar applications in order to update its land use code surrounding utility scale solar. Commissioners passed that moratorium following widespread upset in the Norwood area over a proposed 600-acre project. But when it comes to mining, residents of the area most impacted say no moratorium is necessary. Sean Bond drove to Telluride from Nukla to speak before commissioners.
And I just wanted to come here today to make sure that the commissioners understand there is a loud voice of opposition for a cessation of mining or mining moratorium permits.
He addresses the mine, which is hoping to restart operations.
You know, it's not just a mine. It's called the Sunday Mine. And there's employees there that those annual salaries are somewhere in the area of about $2 million annually that would impose a significant financial impact to our communities.
Meanwhile, Carrie Andrews, director of the Lone Cone Library in Norwood, says tax revenues from extractive industries are vital to their budget. Late last year, an oil drilling operation in Paradox went bankrupt, which, says Andrews, crushed their budget.
As a district trying to manage a facility and continue offering the same level of service, to lose $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 a year is completely difficult to overcome. Let me just put it that way. So if there's an opportunity for, you know, more industry to come to our community, we need it.
As others spoke in opposition to a moratorium, commissioners aligned there will be no mining moratorium in the county at the moment. But the county is planning to update its mining land use codes after it finishes up with solar. And says Commissioner Lance Waring,
I ask all of you to come to the future meetings where we are discussing these land use code amendments, because we're going to be struggling to find a balance that preserves environment, preserves water, and preserves wildlife.
Thus, the search for a balance will continue while the question of a mining revival in San Miguel County remains open.
Discussions surrounding mental and behavioral health in San Miguel County and the region are ever ongoing.
Colorado, for as much fun as we have here, with all of the recreational opportunities that we have, the amazing communities that we have, we also are in the middle of suffering from a mental health epidemic. Colorado sadly holds the sixth worst position in the United States for rates of suicide. And I think, you know, anybody who's been in this community for even a year has seen that and felt that. So there's a lot of different areas where we can be doing better.
That's Melanie Montoya Wasserman, co-executive director at Tri-County Health Network. In 2018, voters in San Miguel County decided to put their money where their mouth is.
A mill levy was passed to support mental and behavioral health services in San Miguel County. So a small amount of property tax is collected from each household each year that goes into this fund and is allocated by the panel.
The panel is the Behavioral Health Solutions Panel. Tri-County Health Network administers the funding. Money goes either towards organizations as grants, to providers in the county for professional development, or into the Behavioral Health Fund, which provides residents funding to help access therapy. Each year, the Behavioral Health Solutions Panel allocates roughly $750,000 to $900,000. John Pandolfo, superintendent of the Telluride School District and chair of the Behavioral Health Solutions Panel, says they allocate funding into four main buckets.
It's mental health counselors and programs in schools, mental health and substance abuse crisis and emergency response services, suicide prevention programs, and alcohol, opioid, and substance abuse prevention and treatment programs.
Looking back at 2023, the panel provided about $500,000 in grant funding to the Telluride Regional Medical Center and Uncompahgre Medical Center for integrated behavioral health programs, the San Miguel Resource Center, the Telluride School District and Mountain School, Tri-County's stigma reduction programs, and a local gather and grieve support group. Here's Carrie Brock, behavioral health administrator at Tri-County and administrator of the panel.
There's a lot of people who lose loved ones here in pretty traumatic ways, whether that's through accidents in the outdoors, which is really traumatic, through suicide, through a bunch of other ways. And it's that group has been really great for people to have a group of people to not feel quite so isolated as they're going through this grief. And it's been a really productive group.
Montoya Wasserman notes grant funding in 2024 is a little more limited, in part due to several multi-year grants allocated in 2023. Three organizations are receiving funds: the Telluride School District, Access Health Systems, and Raíces Sin Fronteras. No singular program is going to solve San Miguel County or the country's challenges when it comes to mental health, but Pandolfo says he's glad to help fund the local programs doing their part to help.
I think a testament to how much it's needed is how much demand there is right now, and how much, I think, appreciation we get from the folks who get a benefit out of that.
Individuals who live or work in San Miguel County are able to apply for the Behavioral Health Fund to help pay for therapy. The fund will provide $110 per session for six therapy sessions. Applications for the fund are available at tchnetwork.org. By the end of the year, Mountain Village residents and visitors will have more choice and ease when it comes to walking, hiking, and biking along local trails. Mountain Village allocated $600,000 in the 2024 budget to fund projects part of its Trails Master Plan, a document passed in 2021 that identifies areas for new trails and outlines goals for trails in Mountain Village, things like ensuring trail users feel safe, providing year-round opportunities for recreation, and developing a trail system that promotes effortless navigation. At a recent town council meeting, Jim Lobey, Transit and Recreation Director for Mountain Village, provided an update on a number of the trails Mountain Village plans to construct and improve this year. The first is the Big Billy's Novice Connector.
It provides a novice biking connection that you can actually uphill and downhill bike without having to navigate that lower Big Billy's Trail, kind of really tough, washed out space that, you know, most even advanced riders would have a hard time climbing. So that's a trail right there that we are going to get done this year.
The next is Stegosaurus Trail. The new construction will push the existing trail along the ridgeline into the woods.
This was in the trails master plan. This has been in the comp plan. This is something that's been on the books for many, many years to get in there and build this trail. It'll make Jurassic one-way bike to the west, and then it'll make Stegosaurus one-way bike to the east.
Walkers will be able to go in both directions. VCA to Boulevard Trail will connect the sidewalk at the Gondola parking garage to the boulevard. Lobey notes there's already a social trail there. This will improve that. The Bear Creek Trail will extend an already existing trail from Lower Bear Creek Trail in Mountain Village to San Joaquin Boulevard. The Meadows Express Trail will be a new segment connecting the Jurassic Trail to the Meadows Trail.
It's going to be a very tough build where that switchback is kind of on the east side of the trail. It is very steep terrain over there, and it's going to require a lot of work to get a trail cut into that. But it's one that we've heard from you know, our residents. It would be great not having to go out and ride their bike on Adams Ranch Road and then hop back on the Meadows Trail behind Coyote Court. It'll be a really nice trail where you can get from the core all the way to Lawson Hill and not see, you know, any road.
Mountain Village will plan for the trail this year with a build in the future. The Boulevard Trail will get a renovation, replacing the retaining walls, widening the trail, and enhancing drainage. Finally, the Elk Loop Pond and Elk Pond to Touchdown Trail.
The Elk Pond Loop is not currently in our trails license agreement with TSG, so we'd have to do some fancy footwork to get that added to our license agreement with TSG. It is all on TSG property, but it would be a loop all the way through. It would require some, you know, some boardwalk through there, through the wet areas. It would be a really nice trail to get you from Town Hall sub area all the way out to, you know, AJ, Russell. Mm-hmm. It'd be a great little addition to our trail system.
Essentially, that's an alternative route to the boulevard then.
Absolutely.
Lobey highlights several other improvements, rerouting trails and ADA sidewalk connections. Mountain Village has also allocated funds to help with wayfinding.
Part of the project is a huge wayfinding component, you know, that gets you from Meadows neighborhood to Village Center, out to Town Hall sub area, out to Highway 145.
Cost for each trail project ranges from $10,000 to over $250,000. Mountain Village also plans to go to the Telluride Mountain Village Owners Association to help fund some of the projects. Through the Trails Master Plan, Mountain Village identified over 40 new trails for construction in the years to come.
Save the date! The town of Telluride and Telluride Ski and Golf are working together on a plan for some of the largest and last undeveloped parcels within town boundaries. Over the coming months, the town and the resort will be working with the Urban Planners Design Workshop to develop a vision for the Carhenge parking lot, the Chair 7 base area, and the surrounding neighborhoods. Possible uses in the area range from commercial space to ski resort storage to tourist infrastructure to, of course, workforce housing. The first opportunity to share your input is next week. The town and Telski are hosting two meetings at the AHA School launch pad, the art school's third floor, to discuss the project and hear input from residents. The dates are Monday, March 11th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. and Tuesday, the 12th from 5:30 to 7. You can learn more at bit.ly/TOT Chair 7 Carhenge.
Walleye, or yellow pike, a freshwater fish native to the northern U.S. and Canada, are coming to the Ridgeway Reservoir. The fish have a substance in their eyes which enhances their vision in murky water and low light conditions. That substance also makes their eyes seemingly opaque, hence the walleye. Colorado Parks and Wildlife will stock the fish in Ridgeway State Park beginning this spring with the aim of diversifying the fishery and increasing angling opportunities for recreators. The walleye will be sterilized to allow CPW to control their populations. Walleye, whose low light vision allows them to prey on fish and avoid anglers in the murkiest depths of the lake, can grow to an enormous size, 30 inches or longer. But that could take years, even a decade. Ridgeway State Park manager John Freeman says walleye fishing is addictive. He notes, quote, "Walleye fishermen travel the country to fish walleye." He adds it's an interesting new moment for fish diversity and for fishermen at the state park.
A bill to incentivize building more high-density housing around public transit cleared its first hurdle at the State House on Wednesday. A legislative committee approved the bill, which puts pressure on cities to meet transit-oriented housing goals or lose out on state highway funding. The measure would primarily apply to Front Range communities along the I-25 corridor, communities outside of metro areas that have less than 4,000 people, or minimal transit service would be exempt. The bill is part of Governor Jared Polis's plan to address the state's housing shortage and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It heads next to the House for debate.
States that use water from the Colorado River have unveiled two separate and conflicting proposals for how the river should be managed in the future. KUNC's Alex Hager reports they're under pressure to come to an agreement before the current rules expire in 2026.
Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico are behind one proposal. They say climate change means less snow in the mountains where the river starts, and their states are bearing the brunt of the consequences. They're proposing cutbacks on the amount of water they send downstream to their neighbors each year. Those downstream states, California, Arizona, and Nevada, argue that would go against long-standing legal agreements and shouldn't be allowed. Their own proposal to the federal government includes a new method of figuring out when it's time to cut back on water use. All seven states say they want to keep working and find some agreement, but urgency is building as water managers try to reach a deal ahead of a possible administration change after November's presidential election. I'm Alex Hager.
Spring snowpack has been on the decline in the Rocky Mountain West for the past several decades. In addition to reducing water supply, the reduction in snowpack is increasing fire danger. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, KGNU's Luke Ryan spoke to Professor Anne Nolan with the University of Nevada, Reno. She's co-authored a paper on the connection between wildfire and snowpack.
We have over 1,000 stations across the western United States where the Natural Resources Conservation Service has been measuring snowpack since the late 70s and early 80s. And at 93% of these stations, we see declines in snowpacks, and the average decline is about 23%. And we also see an earlier snowmelt, on average, again, by about 18 days of earlier snow disappearance across the west.
So what does this decline in snowpack mean for wildfire season?
Yeah, so if we have declining snowpacks, we have an earlier snow disappearance date, and that means that our dry season is going to start earlier. We might have an earlier, longer fire season. We definitely see this relationship statistically between an earlier snow disappearance date and the length and intensity and severity of the fire season and the number of fires during that fire season. So now we've got a fire season that is significantly increased. Of course, the Marshall Fire in late December, 2 years ago. Snow serves as a reservoir for moisture and accumulates during the winter. And it doesn't melt really until we get to spring and early summer. And it provides a moisture subsidy for forests and ecosystems. Now, if that snow melt occurs earlier, then you're going to have a longer dry season. And our mountain forests have been experiencing more and more of these long dry seasons. And therefore, they're experiencing more moisture stress. And they're more vulnerable to fires because they're drier. And these dry fuels are really a critical ingredient for wildfire.
What about down here in the plains where we have a lot of grasses and you're getting a lot of snowmelt and precipitation early on?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's different in the mountains where you've got forests and where you might have earlier snowmelt creating vulnerable conditions by late summer. But when you have earlier snowmelt in the grasslands in the spring, you're exposing those to sunlight and those grasses can grow up earlier. But then again, with less snow and a longer dry season, you can have a lot of grasses that dry out early and you might have a really challenging grassland fire season. We're seeing some of this in Texas right now, in the panhandle of Texas and into Oklahoma.
Can you walk us through the negative feedback loop that arises after these fires burn through a forest or a grassland?
After a fire, we see that the burned woody debris and black carbon that's shed from those burned remaining trees blacken the snowpack surface, and the lack of a forest canopy no longer shading the snowpack allows it to absorb all that extra sunlight. So we've kind of preconditioned the snow to have more incoming sunlight, earlier snowmelt, and that lasts for 10, 15 years after a fire, according to my colleague, Dr. Kelly Gleason at Portland State University. We hypothesize that the regrowing vegetation and the hydrology will be changing in ways that we might not expect for years after a fire.
The National Weather Service forecast for the Western San Juans calls for snow showers tonight with a low around 20 degrees. 1 to 2 inches of snow accumulation is possible. Friday, expect snow showers in the afternoon with partly sunny skies and a high in the mid-30s. Friday night should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow showers and a low around 15. Saturday calls for mostly sunny skies during the day and mostly clear skies at night with a high near 35 degrees and a low around 15 degrees. This has been the news for Thursday, March 7th. Thanks for listening. If you have a story idea or a news tip, call the news team at 970-728-3206. And now, personal commentaries.
We hope you can join us for our upcoming Spring Sing concerts on Friday, March 8th and Sunday, March 10th. Our artistic director, Hal Adler, and the Telluride Choral Society have an amazing set of songs to present to you, from Bach to Jacob Collier and everywhere in between. Our theme, Beauty in Beginnings and Endings, plays out through the concert with Sing My Child, a celebration of childhood and strength, and then a beautiful, hopeful song, Let My Love Be Heard. We'll be reminded of the beauty in all things and in all stages of life. There will also be a sing-along piece for the audience called Little Blue by Jacob Collier and arranged by our own Amy Vanderbosch. Tegan Kessner, our new youth artistic director, has our kids at the top of their game. So come join us on Friday, March 8th at 7 p.m. or Sunday, March 10th at 4 p.m. They're both at Christ Church, and tickets are at the door. And do check out Susan Vibrock's Telluride Inside and Out for more details. This is Ginny Fraser, and thank you, Kodo.
Hey there, this is Mary from the Telluride Historical Museum with your Miner's Minute. If you haven't made it up the hill yet this winter season, check out our current exhibit, Festival Capital of the Rockies, 50 Years of Festivals in Telluride. Come and discover the answers to all the questions you have and more regarding our festivals in the Weatherford Gallery. This exhibit will be open until we close for the off-season in April, so don't miss out. The Telluride Historical Museum is seeking a friendly, outgoing, and engaging individual to serve as a visitor services coordinator. The visitor services coordinator works at the museum's front desk and provides all services associated with front desk responsibilities, including greeting and orienting guests upon arrival, taking payment for admission, gift shop sales, answering questions during guest visits, and restocking gift shop inventory. This is a part-time role starting immediately, specifically scheduled for Saturdays during the winter season, with opportunities to work more during the summer season. Our 2024 Daffodil Days are almost here again. Pre-sales begin online February 19th. Place your orders early and get a discounted price of $12 a bundle, or purchase them on Main Street at the community table from our regular dates of March 11th to 15th, and up at the museum for bundles in person at the regular price at $15 a bundle. All proceeds benefit the Telluride Historical Museum and the American Cancer Society. A reminder of our hours. We are open for the winter season Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. with last entries at 4:30 p.m. And remember, Saturdays are always free for locals. Kids scavenger hunts are also available, so be sure to bring your littles. Also, be sure to check out our gift shop for some items that are on sale. We have brand new inventory, including gems, toys, games, and vintage-inspired jewelry and accessories as well. If you have any additional questions, feel free to call the museum at 970-728-3344 or email info@tellurydemuseum.org. We look forward to hearing from you. And we hope to see you up the hill on First Street soon, or follow us on social media to keep in touch with what's up at the museum. Thanks, Kyoto. You're a medium rare. Well done.
Opinions broadcast over KOTO are those of the speakers. You are also invited to express your views after the news or on Access each weekday at around 4 p.m. If you would like to comment, please contact a staff person here at KOTO. We encourage you to speak out on important public issues.